Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today on the show, we're talking all about air quality and air pollution, from how it's measured to what it looks like in our state. And our guest to help us out is Tracy Holloway. She's a professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison, leads an air quality research program in the Nelson Institute Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, an air quality scientist working at the intersection of air quality, energy, climate, public health, and she leads the NASA Health and Air Quality Applied Sciences team. So it's great to have her with us. We'll talk about understanding air pollution and all the regulations, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments as we move along today. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Tracy Holloway, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I think when we think about air pollution problems, we tend to think about big cities, New York, L.A., Chicago, maybe. But Wisconsin has its own concerns related to air pollution, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we're thinking about chemicals in the air, you know, sometimes it can be overwhelming to think about all these chemical names that you've never heard of. But in the United States and around the world, there's really two big air pollution problems that dominate the headlines. And one is ozone, which happens near the ground, and we'll be talking about that a lot, I know, today. And the other is particulate pollution, which are like suspended particles. Even the dust storm coming over from Africa now is a type of particle pollution. So really, ozone and particle pollution are often problems over wider scales, so not just in the city, but over whole states or coastlines. And ozone is a problem for Wisconsin because a lot of ozone is formed over water bodies. And so most of the counties along Lake Michigan show real high levels of ozone right near the lake. And ozone is often referred to as smog. So when you hear about smog, the main component of smog that we're really talking about is ozone.
So that means that there are certain regions in the state that are bigger problem areas. Those along the lake, for example, like Door County, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. There's most of the monitors, the little instruments that measure this chemical, are located near the lakeshore, but there's also monitors across the state in inland areas. But the highest values are typically right near the shoreline.
Yeah. And what are some common contributors to air pollution from a particulate standpoint?
Yeah, so particulate matter is a catch-all term for any solids or liquids in air. So it could be smoke from the barbecue. It could be dust from an unpaved road. But it can also be chemicals that kind of cook up in the atmosphere from emissions from coal-fired power plants, like sulfur dioxide, emissions from cars and trucks. And so I sometimes describe when I'm teaching that there's different flavors of particulate matter, and the different flavors come from different sources. Like the black smoke from a barbecue is different than the windblown dust from the desert, but they both are grouped as particulate matter. With ozone, the ingredients that form ozone are two different gases that are both invisible, and then they cook up in the atmosphere to form ozone smog, which is also invisible.
So the city of Sheboygan ranked in the top 25 of the most polluted metropolitan areas for ozone?
Yeah, because, you know, this idea that so much is made over Lake Michigan, in the summertime, winds tend to move from the south to the north. And when we think about what are the major activities going on south of Lake Michigan, we have Chicago and Gary, Indiana. We also have Racine and Milwaukee and just a lot of larger cities. And then the air is carrying the emissions, the pollution that comes from those power plants and cities north over the lake where it cooks up to form high levels of ozone. And then that ozone is transported to the land. So around the world, we see high ozone levels, often right near water bodies. And in the Great Lakes, it's common to see high ozone levels all around the shoreline of the Great Lakes, including, of course, Wisconsin's many counties adjacent to Lake Michigan.
Yeah. And why is it, just to kind of review, why is ozone a problem?
Yeah, ozone irritates the lungs. It can irritate the eyes. At high enough levels, it can degrade plastic and rubber. So it's one of these chemicals that we've known for a long time is damaging to human health. It was first discovered in Los Angeles in the 1930s and 40s when the concentrations were so high that actually in the public thought that they were being attacked in World War II. But it wasn't a chemical attack. It was just very, very high levels of this irritating ozone gas. And they discovered through science in the 40s and 50s and the 60s, and it's continuing, the role that these two ingredients, nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, how they react together to form ozone. And those reactions occur on hot, sunny days. So here in Wisconsin, we only get high ozone during the summertime or the late spring and early fall. But we get it because of emissions that come from cars and trucks and power plants, as well as industrial sources, and even trees and plants. We've talked about these VOCs. When you walk through a pine forest and you smell that nice piney smell, that is actually a VOC. It's called alpha pinene, and that's one of many VOCs that come from trees. So this is not just a city problem. It's something that comes from a lot of different sources and can be cooked up over big areas.
Tracy Holloway, our guest, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, an air quality scientist. We're talking with her about air pollution and climate change in Wisconsin. I want to bring that up as well. Questions for her, give a call, maybe an experience to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And climate change, what kind of a role does it play in air quality?
Yeah, there's some really interesting links between climate and air quality. The first is that the same activities that emit nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide also emit carbon dioxide. So we're mainly concerned with carbon dioxide for climate, but we're concerned with these other chemicals because of their impact on human health. So the good news is that anything that we're doing to reduce energy use or move to cleaner fuel sources or renewable energy, that's a win-win. We get a win for climate by having less carbon dioxide, and we get a win for public health by having cleaner air. So I think the climate change and air quality issues are very closely coupled when we start talking about energy and solutions. But they are also coupled because when we have hotter summers and longer summers, that is making the conditions right for having more of this ozone cooking up. And the good news is we've been decreasing emissions of these ingredients to ozone. But if we have hotter summers, those gains, we might take a step backwards and actually have dirtier air just because the weather is hotter.
Yeah. Mary from central Wisconsin has some concerns about air quality where she lives. She lives near an industrial farm, worried about airborne particulates, and says her area experiences dust storms once a month as well. Mm-hmm. This is central Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. It even caused car pileup accidents. She sees it as something due to maybe to mismanagement or bad practices and has impacted the quality of life for those around her. That's a very specific area. A comment on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting to hear about her experience. I think it speaks to the fact that these different chemicals come from so many different sources, from unpaved roads, from agriculture, from power plants, from, all sorts of different sources. So there's not just a one-step solution. It's something that, depending on where you are and what the chemical that you're concerned with, the solutions may be everything from cleaner cars to changing agricultural practices. And I think that, you know, it's one of these things that's not just an urban problem. One of the misconceptions is that urban air pollution is bad and rural air pollution is fine, or air quality is fine or good. But oftentimes you do get really high levels of air pollution in places that you wouldn't expect it.
Yeah. Let's go to Jay in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Hi, Jay. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I've got a couple questions and a couple observations. We in Two Rivers stick out into Lake Michigan quite noticeably, and our climate is often different from Manitowoc, just a few miles to our south. So I'm wondering if you have any specific information on ozone levels in my location, considering that we do stick out and may catch more of the southerly wind. However, we frequently have wind off of the lake from the southeast to the northeast, and I'm wondering if that mitigates some of the impact. In fact, our wind direction will be different than Manitowoc or cities inland. And I've got a very old, about a 30-year-old black rubber garden hose that stays out all year round. I don't use it in the winter, but it has yet to deteriorate. So I don't know if that's any indicator of ozone levels, but you did mention something about rubber and plastic breaking down.
All right. Jay, thank you for calling. Tracy, comments?
Yeah, Jay, thank you for the questions. And first I'll note that the impacts of ozone on rubber tend to happen at really high concentrations, like ones that we really are not talking about anymore here in Wisconsin. One thing a lot of people don't realize is that air pollution in the United States is much, much lower today than it was 30 years ago, even 10 years ago. And with the 1970 Clean Air Act, that was really a turning point. And after that, air pollution across the United States has been getting cleaner and cleaner. Air quality has been getting better and better. So some of the really high levels that we used to see that would degrade rubber, we don't see anymore. The bad news is that even at lower concentrations like we experience in a typical summer in Wisconsin, those are associated with health impacts like asthma, and also decreasing crop yields, depending on the crop. So it's one of these things. I wouldn't put too much stock in the rubber hose, but it is something that if you were there, maybe depending on if you were in a city and if you were in Los Angeles 30 years ago, your rubber hose may have been degraded. but the question of where what the ozone levels are doing with the wind direction, that is exactly what I love to study. And so I'm glad I love the question. The in fact, my appointment is part in the Nelson Institute and also in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So it's great that you're going to be having John Martin and Steve Ackerman on later today, my colleagues there, because air pollution, like any other thing in the atmosphere, varies day to day with the weather. And so some days it's going to be high and some days it's going to be low. When you have an area that has bad ozone, it doesn't mean that it's bad every day. All it really means is that under certain weather conditions, it can cook up to levels that are considered unhealthy for humans to breathe. And but what is the ozone at any one particular spot? The real way that we know that is whether we have a monitor. And these monitors are expensive to put in and expensive to maintain. I've always heard the number about $100,000 a year to install a new $100,000 to install a new monitor and about $20,000 a year to maintain the monitor. This is totally just a ballpark, but just to give you an idea of what expensive means. So it's not something that can be done everywhere. In the state of Wisconsin, we have about 30 ozone monitors, some spread inland in the state, many along the lakeshore. But for places that we don't have a monitor, we actually don't really know what the ozone is doing in those places. I sometimes use the metaphor of, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, doesn't make a sound. It's very similar when it comes to air pollution. If we have a high ozone event and there's no monitor, does it exist? And from the perspective of the EPA or the DNR, you know, it's not counted. If you don't have a monitor, we just can't count it at all. So depending on where you are, I'm not sure what the closest monitor to you is, but there may not be a nearby monitor. And that's one of the challenges of studying air pollution, is that we only have measurements where we have these monitors placed.
Ah, there we go. Jay, thank you so much for calling. Tracy, thanks for that great answer. Tracy Holloway, professor in the departments of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences and in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, our guest. Questions for her as we talk air pollution and climate change in Wisconsin? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. At about 10:45, we'll talk with our weather guys about those tropical storms and the giant dust plumes and the record-breaking lightning flashes, among other things, with them. But right now, we're taking a look at air pollution with our guest, Tracy Holloway, works with those our weather guys, and she also works in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Great to have her with us today. And questions for her about air pollution? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you could email us, the email address is ideas@wpr.org. Nate, I had wondered if you knew anything about the history of the monitoring tower in Sheboygan. He mentioned there may have been some efforts to decommission it due to the results they were getting. Do you know anything about that?
Sheboygan sticks out a little bit further into Lake Michigan than some of the other locations along the coastline, and it consistently shows some of the highest ozone in the state. And we've known for a long time that this is because the ozone is formed over Lake Michigan and is exported to the coastal counties. And the traditional way of deciding where to place those monitors and how to do regulation is that states and the federal EPA work together to decide what counties need to be monitored and to invest in the monitoring system. And they usually put the monitors where they think it's going to be the worst, because if you want to say, is this county passing or failing, they focus on where it would be likely the worst air pollution. And then if that air pollution is clean enough, then they assume the whole county is clean enough. And if it's dirty, then they call the whole county failing, or what the EPA term is non-attainment. That's the typical way that this process works. And that's the way it's worked in Wisconsin for ozone for a long time, all the way back to the 1970s. But the flip side of that story is that we know that just because it's high in one place doesn't mean that it's high in the entire county. So, you know, there's this balance, because we know that the air pollution monitors in one place don't necessarily represent the whole county. On the other hand, we specifically put the monitors in the worst possible place for the county. and that's kind of a paradox, is what's driving a lot of the controversy around deciding whether the counties are passing or failing the ozone standard. And in the case of Sheboygan, when you have, you know, Sheboygan is not a big industrial city, although it does have a lot of industrial sources there near the lakeside. But everybody knows that inflow from Chicago, from Milwaukee, from Gary are part of the problem affecting Sheboygan. But Sheboygan's not unique in this aspect. That's the way it is across the entire United States. The entire United States monitors air pollution and expects that when counties are failing, that they will put in take measures, and the state will take measures to reduce emissions. And that approach has been in place. It's not perfect, but it's been in place for a long time, and it's led to major improvements in our air quality. The reason air pollution in the United States is getting cleaner is because of these rules, and that these rules force reductions in emissions and improvements in technology, and then that makes the air cleaner. So So Sheboygan is just one kind of microcosm of a challenge that's affecting the whole United States, which is what do you do when there's a really bad monitor in a county that's not totally responsible for its own air pollution, because air moves from place to place, just like the weather. So, you know, I think that the debate has been saying, well, we shouldn't count that Sheboygan monitor because it's not representative of the whole county. But then the flip side is, no, well, it's in Sheboygan and it's measuring air in Sheboygan. So we put it there because it was the dirtiest monitor. So, you know, different sides view this very, very differently. It's a rather politically charged issue, because when you have a county that's failing these air quality standards, then the industries and the individuals in those counties are often subject to more expensive controls. And just as an example, if anyone listening has ever taken their car to be emissions tested, that's something that you typically do in a county that's failing the ozone standard, but it's not something you usually do in a county that's passing the ozone standard. And that's something that's just at the individual level with your own car, but industries and power plants and other facilities can be subject to very, very expensive millions of dollars of regulations if their county is failing instead of passing. So companies have a real vested interest in trying to advocate that a county should pass. But the reason we have these rules in place is to protect public health. So we often have public health advocates saying that we should not be passing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. But I can see the point of view of a business person, a man or woman, who suddenly finds they've got to, you know, spend $500,000 on something to make it less of a problem, the air quality less of a problem, and they might be thinking, well, if this is going to cost, why should I have to pay the whole brunt of this? Why shouldn't there be some financial assistance of some sort?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's not an easy problem.
No, not an easy problem for sure. Keith in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Larry. I was wondering about diesel locomotives. What kind of pollution do they produce, and who regulates diesel locomotives, and have there been any improvements in how much pollution they produce over the years?
Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, that's a real good question. Diesel locomotives and highway vehicles in general tend to be regulated at the federal level as opposed to the state level, because they cross state lines. So the way that the air pollution is dealt with for a power plant that's just in a state is different than the way that it's dealt with for vehicles that crisscross across highways. In general, burning diesel, whether you're burning it in a generator, a backup generator for your house, or in a construction equipment, or in a train, it emits a lot of the ingredients for ozone, especially nitrogen oxides or NOx. And it also emits particulate matter. You can sometimes, you know, see that big plume of smoke coming off. And anytime you see a plume of smoke, that is particulate matter. A few years ago, one of my students and I did a study to look at what the air pollution issues would be if we started shipping more by trains instead of trucks, because you can carry a lot more on a train with less air pollution per mile. But overall, more trains would lead to more air pollution along the train tracks, and more trucks lead to more air pollution along the highways. So one of the issues is that they run in different areas.
Interesting. Okay, Keith, thank you so much. Mark in Manitowoc, hello.
Hi, I'm a little bit of a follow-up question as it related to the Sheboygan non-attainment situation. I'm somewhat aware that they several years ago installed a second monitor, not at the Colorandre site, but farther inland. And I get that, as you had mentioned, that typically the monitors are, and this is the way it's been done since the 70s, are put in the highest area. But is it necessarily accurate? You referenced accurate from the standpoint of the the source. It measures, you know, it gets at the location of the non-attain, or the location of the ozone, but not the source. You identified Gary, Indiana, Chicago, Milwaukee, and take, for instance, Sheboygan. You have non-attainment along the lakeshore. My understanding is there's attainment further in, and I think they may have split or proposed to split the county into two, non-attainment and attainment. But in the end, you know, if we are measuring in a county and that affects the, you know, and potentially vilifies the businesses there because it is a non-attainment zone, is that a true representation? And I think that was the push in Sheboygan as to trying to get two monitors to say, hey, this location is, you have the prevailing westerlies and the coastal winds, and it's going to congregate along the coastline, and it's not coming from Sheboygan or from, Sheboygan County.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So absolutely. You know, you have raised a lot of really good points here. And first of all, that they put a second monitor in Sheboygan in 2014, specifically to see what's happening as that air is moving inland. And they put the monitor about a little between 3 and 4 miles away from the coastline. And it does see much lower values than the monitor at right along the shore. And if we had if money was not limited, or if these monitors become much cheaper, then it would be fantastic to put lots and lots of monitors all around, so we could really see how air pollution is changing in space and time. But based on these two monitors in Sheboygan, the caller's absolutely right that they have split Sheboygan and, in fact, most of the coastal counties into two zones, one that is near the lake, about 3 miles in from the lakeshore, which they considered are failing the ozone standards, and then the rest of the county inland, which they consider to be passing the ozone standards. This is an unusual approach. Most counties are either all failing or all passing, but Wisconsin's not the only place that has done that. There's other precedents for splitting the ozone pass-fail distinction in some counties in the western United States and a few other places. But it's not the only place that's done it, but it is an unusual approach. And there's no question that ozone is highest along the lakeshore. No question about that. And so, you know, your caller is raising the right issues that, you know, is it fair to make a particular county reduce their emissions when they're not the source of the problem? You know, I think that one challenge here is that we have states can control what they do, so we can't control what Illinois does. There have been efforts to coordinate air pollution control across the United States or across the eastern United States or in multi-state areas, because just like we're upwind or downwind from Chicago, we are also upwind from Michigan. Some of Michigan's air pollution comes from Wisconsin. So there's this real challenge of figuring out what is a way that you can move clean air forward to make sure that our air is healthy enough to protect our kids and the elderly and people with respiratory disease and, you know, all of us, while still not putting too much penalty on somebody, especially if they can't do anything about it. And, you know, I think that at this point, most of the regulation for air pollution is by forcing counties to reduce their own air pollution. But there have been some efforts, especially around power plant emissions, to coordinate across the eastern United States.
There we go. Thank you, Mark, for calling. Alex in Nisida has something that relates, I believe. Alex, hi. Alex, are you there? Tell you what, Alex had a question about an ethanol plant in Nisida, wondering, and there has been some rumors about that has resulted in poor air quality, and wondering if that's something you're familiar with.
I'm not familiar with that particular plant. You know, certainly any industrial facility that is burning fuel there's sort of a few different ways that an industrial facility can affect air quality. One is when they're burning fuel, there may be smoke that comes off, there may be invisible gases that come off that affect air pollution levels. There may also be evaporative emissions. You know, when you have chemicals that are sort of smelly, often when you have kind of smelly chemicals, those are associated with VOC emissions. You can think about even when you're filling up your gas tank and you sort of smell that smell of the evaporating gasoline, that is some air pollution coming just from the evaporation into the air. And then I'd say, you know, the third way that it can make a difference is in housing, what's doing to the land nearby, both in terms of kicking up dust from unpaved roads, or sometimes places have, you know, a coal pile and then there's windblown coal dust affecting the nearby community, or with large animal operations, the smell of the animals. So, you know, there's a lot of ways that an industrial facility can affect the nearby air pollution, but then some of that is transported over wide areas. And, you know, to the question, just one more thing on the Sheboygan that ties these two together, is that in any one place, air pollution is being controlled by local sources, by regional sources, like other places in the state or the region, but also sometimes, you know, forest fires in Canada, or even industrial activity in Asia. All of these can play contributing roles to air pollution everywhere else. And so it is a tricky matter to figure out how do we link a particular source and a particular problem, because they may not occur in the same place.
Yeah. Steve in Superior has a question. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Wondering if you have measurements for the ozone levels along Lake Superior, and specifically in Superior, Wisconsin.
All right.
So I think there is an ozone monitor in Bad River, and then there's an ozone monitor in the Potawatomi Nation, and then there's an ozone monitor in Newport, Door County. Those are in Trout Lake also, but I think Bad River would be the only ozone monitor along Lake Superior, and it shows values that are well below the threshold that the EPA determines to be unhealthy. So across most of the DNR puts out a report every year that outlines all the air pollution data for Wisconsin, as well as the emissions, sort of what's going into the atmosphere from our cars and trucks and industrial facilities. And that is a great, I'll send the link to Larry and Natalie. That it has a lot of information, and it has the locations of all the different monitors in Wisconsin, and they're color-coded, you know, green if they're well below the standard, yellow if they're getting close to the standard, red if they're a little bit above the standard, and purple if they're quite a bit above the standard. And the Bad River monitor along Lake Superior is in the green.
And you can find that. Just go to WPR.org/Larry and look in the comment section, and we'll have that. We had you were talking history a little bit earlier, and we had someone email Ann in Madison. She remembers about a decade ago, Madison used to occasionally have what were called air quality emergency days. They usually happen during hot weather, but bus rides would be free on those days. She said they haven't seemed to have these declared in many years. Is the air quality that much better that doesn't happen anymore, or something else?
Yeah, I've been interested in that issue also. So the air pollution is getting better, but I think one of the reasons that, you know, those action days have been less in the news is in part trying to kind of figure out what are the strategies that are going to be most effective. And the funny thing about ozone in an urban area is that when you have really high levels of ozone, they can get so high that they start reacting with the nitrogen oxides, which is to say that this ingredient that had been making ozone at high enough levels actually starts to eat it up. So we go from contributing to ozone to actually eating up the ozone. This leads to this weird effect that on really bad ozone days in typically just urban areas, if you reduce your nitrogen oxides, you actually see a bump in ozone. We saw this in California. Oftentimes they'd see a little higher ozone on the weekends than on the weekdays, because on the weekdays there was so much pollution that the pollution started kind of eating up each other, so to speak. And so, you know, I think one question is whether those take the bus initiatives were actually helpful. And also, did they move the ball forward in terms of making a difference in attitudes and awareness and cleaning the air? Or was it, you know, if it wasn't really having an effect, sometimes it may be better to focus public outreach on something different. So I haven't been involved in those air quality alert activities from the DNR, but I know when I first moved here to Wisconsin in 2003, there were often these air quality alert days and air quality action days, but that has not been something that's continued. So it's a good observation, and I think that's multiple reasons why they may have discontinued it.
Yeah. Another listener wonders what happened to the hole in the ozone layer that was so controversial a few years back. Isn't the ozone layer what helps protect life from harmful UV light?
I am so glad that this question came up, and I should have brought it up myself at the very beginning, because ozone is an invisible gas that is good way up high in the stratosphere. Sometimes with ozone, we say good up high, bad nearby. Because way up in the stratosphere, ozone occurs naturally and is a layer that helps protect sunlight from causing, from doing damage to skin and plants and just sunburn and cancer. But just like you wouldn't drink your sunblock, we don't want to breathe in that ozone layer. So the ozone that occurs naturally up high is the focus of the ozone hole, which does still occur every fall in the over the South Pole. But that's different than this kind of ozone smog that is created, that we're talking about today, that created from human and natural emissions near the surface that we're actually breathing in. And there's some places like mountaintops and mountainous areas, when some of the natural ozone from the stratosphere comes down to the surface and can actually lead to some of these same kind of ozone violations that we're talking about. So it is the same chemical. It's just that how it's produced and where it is different.
Are you, so we're kind of running out of time. Are you happy enough with the kinds of standards that we have, these federal quality standards, for example, and state quality standards?
Well, you know, I view it really as a success story in many ways, because since the launch of the Clean Air Act, the air in the United States has been getting cleaner and cleaner. And the approach that we use here in the U.S. has been a model for the way the World Health Organization talks about air pollution and many other countries. So in many ways, air pollution control has been a success story. But that doesn't mean that we're in the clear, because there's still nearly half of the U.S. population lives in areas that are considered unhealthy based on these standards. And as we think about ways to control for both climate pollutants and health pollutants, there's going to be new solutions that are needed, because even though we've done a really good job in many places making our air healthier, we're still emitting a lot of carbon dioxide. So I think thinking about new strategies for energy that can offer the win-win solutions to reduce carbon and all these health damaging pollutants, I think that's really where we need to go in the future.
Yeah. Well, Tracy, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Would you come back sometime and be with us again?
Absolutely. It's been a real pleasure, Larry. Thank you so much.
Tracy Holloway, professor in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And speaking of that department, our weather guys are associated with that department as well. And we'll hear from them next as we talk weather and climate with our weather guys. So you stay with us.